It is Monday, August the 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, turns out the gunman on a Paris-bound train was somewhat inept with his weapon.
We would have all been in trouble and probably wouldn't be here today, along with a lot of other people.
Also ahead, heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula, plus a possible side deal over Iran's nuclear agenda. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Later today, French President François Hollande will bestow France's highest decoration, the Legion of Honor, on three Americans and a man from Britain who subdued a heavily armed gunman aboard a high-speed train on Friday. The Americans spoke Sunday at the U.S. Embassy in Paris. Lisa Bryant has more now on how they stopped a possible bloodbath.
Sitting together before reporters for the first time, Americans Spencer Stone, Alex Garlatos, and Anthony Sadler described how they overpowered assailant Ayub El-Hazani on the high-speed train to Paris. Stone wore a thick bandage on the thumb that El-Hazani almost cut off during the struggle. Both Stone and Garlatos have military training, but Garlatos said a survival instinct, not the training, drove their actions.
I feel our training mostly kicked in after this assailant was already subdued, frankly, when it came to medical care and things like that, and providing security, making sure there wasn't another shooter. But in the beginning, it was mostly just gut instinct.
The three Americans, along with a Briton and a Frenchman, have been praised for averting what could have been a bloodbath on the train, which was carrying 554 people. They meet French President François Hollande early Monday. Moroccan-born Hazani was heavily armed, but nobody died in the attack. Garlatos suggests he had little experience handling weapons.
He clearly had no firearms training whatsoever. And yes, if he knew what he was doing, or even just got lucky and did the right thing, he would have been able to operate through all eight of those magazines, and we would have all been in trouble and probably wouldn't be here today, along with a lot of other people.
French investigators continue to question Hazani, who is believed to have links to radical Islam and may have traveled to Syria. On Sunday, his lawyers told French TV the assailant is shocked to be linked to terrorism. She says he claims to have found the weapons hidden away and hoped to use them to rob passengers. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And now to the tensions between North and South Korea. Officials from both countries resume marathon talks on Sunday afternoon after continued deep into night in an urgent bid to avert potential conflict on the peninsula. Initial talks that began on Saturday were adjourned for 10 hours early into the hours of Sunday. Officials have not publicly commented on the discussions, and there is no word on whether the negotiations are making any progress or how long they'll continue. However, as the talks started up again on Sunday, South Korea reported unusual troop and submarine movement in the north. Pyongyang has moved 70% of its submarines away from their bases, and the vessels are now undetectable, according to South Korea's defense ministry. Ministry spokesman characterized the movement as unprecedented. The north has also doubled its frontline artillery strength at the border with the south, according to South Korea. We turn now to VOA's Jim Stevenson for the latest from the peninsula during the very early morning hours today in Seoul. Jim begins a conversation with Steve Miller of Asia News Weekly, inquiring about a brief pause in the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises.
Yeah, so the annual games were underway, and they briefly paused them. And I think that was just a measure of a sign of how Seoul was reacting to the tensions from North Korea. The games were actually paused really briefly and then set to go back in motion. So I don't think it was necessarily a good indicator that the United States was truly worried, but really wanted to pause and really coordinate all efforts with Seoul just to make sure there weren't any hiccups should something go down that would be a rather negative aspect.
We've been hearing a lot of rhetoric from North Korea, at least through the international media. What have you been hearing in Seoul?
Well, we hear the same bellicose rhetoric being reported through major news organizations, including Yonhap here in South Korea. But to the average person on the street, the average person in Seoul, it's still business as usual. We see this as part of the typical cycle of escalation of tensions by North Korea, then the eventual dance that decreases them, and we get into a lull. What I think people are a little more concerned about this time is that we are seeing some troop movements near the border, the deployment of 50 out of their 70 submarines recently, and the recall of all the F-16s from Alaska. I think that's a little bit different than we saw, say, in 2013, last time we had this amount of tension on the peninsula. But for the average person, it's still the same thing we see. So there isn't a lot of concern out on the streets.
You mentioned the movement of submarines, and this is something a little bit unusual, I guess, that we really haven't encountered before.
Right, and that was one of the things that a lot of analysts picked up on. And this kind of deployment of submarines is largely unprecedented, and known why North Korea opted to do that. Some feel that perhaps the talks in Panmunjom are just a diversionary tactic, and some of the submarines may carry out operations. It's really unclear. As you know, over in the northern limit line area, over on the western border of the Koreas, it's not exactly the most secure area, and there have been skirmishes in the past, so there is a potential for something to happen there.
There were some intense talks going on between the North and the South. Is that a usual occurrence when things tend to flare up like this?
Well, it's typically what we want to see. We always want to see that dialogue going on. The talks began Sunday evening, lasted way into the early mornings on Sunday, and then they resumed Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening. And as we're having this conversation, they're still reporting that the talks are still going on at this moment with no details being released. So hopefully this is the phase that we typically see where both sides can come together, can come and reach an agreement that will ultimately de-escalate the tension.
All throughout this, there's a common theme of reunification, at least getting some of the families together that have been separated. How's that going?
Well, that's always what we want to see this time of year. Chuseok, the Korean Thanksgiving, will occur towards the end of September 2015. And it's always nice to try and get families together that were separated by the 1950-1953 Korean War. And sometimes in the past, North Korea has used that as a bargaining chip to try and get either sanctions alleviated or some other kind of aid from South Korea or the West. So they could possibly even use that as some kind of bargaining chip to get those propaganda speakers turned off, promise to hold family reunions this year, and it could be a pathway to finally de-escalate the situation.
Well, it's always nice to speak with you. From Seoul, Steve Miller. He's a radio, television, and internet travel news expert. And you can hear him podcasting at Asia News Weekly. Right, Steve?
That's right. Thank you, Jim.
Yes, and thank you, Jim and Steve. Now we turn to International's Editions, G. Abby Lee, joining us now to continue our conversation about the situation on the Korean Peninsula and specifically what's being said about it all on Twitter. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. The other Steve Miller, was absolutely right when he said, for an average person, it's business as usual in South Korea. And that sentiment was reflected on Twitter Sunday. To give you a feel for it, hashtag Korea was used less than hashtag K-pop, the Korean pop music. So both hashtags were used in about 4,000 tweets respectively during the last 24 hours. And if you think about it, hashtag Korea encompasses everything from inter-Korean relations to Korean food. And a lot of the tweets that use hashtag Korea weren't even talking about the security issues.
And gee, what about some Twitter handles that we can follow to keep updated on the news?
Well, let's begin with Steve Miller for Asia News Weekly podcast, the one we just heard from. He's on Twitter at Steve Miller ANW. Our own Steve Herman at W7VOA is also a great person to follow. He's currently VOA's Southeast Asia Bureau Chief, but he did report from Seoul, South Korea for a few years. Last but not least, the first AP Bureau Chief in Pyongyang, Jin Lee, is on Twitter at NewsJin. She's also on Instagram with the same handle and posts very insightful and rare photos from both Koreas. Steve, as tensions rise along the DMZ, a VOA article is getting a lot of attention on the website. It was a piece by the Korean Service published 3 days ago titled "Experts Predict North Korea Will Escalate Provocations." And that's exactly what's happening right now. So in some ways, the skirmishes were more or less expected. In that article, experts said tensions will continue to rise until the Washington-Seoul summit slated for mid-October. Steve?
Many thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Here's a reminder for you. You can follow us, International Edition, on Twitter. We're at VOA_IE. Still ahead on the program, countering the Islamic State's propaganda. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Islamic State's claim to be an Islamic caliphate has raised concerns that its ambitions to capture and administer territory have no geographic limits. International Edition correspondent Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, former coordinator of the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism and Communications, about the rise of the Islamic State group, and tells my colleague Susan Yaki its plan is to counter IS propaganda.
He mentioned several causes, starting with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. inaction toward the Syrian crisis, the economic grievances in the Middle East, and political exclusion, among other factors.
After the Arab Spring, you had weakened states, you had anarchy develop in Syria, and you had a dysfunctional, incompetent government in Iraq. So there was a vacuum, there was an ungoverned space that the Islamic State sought to fill. And so you basically, the implosion that happened in Syria and the implosion that happened, the vacuum that was created in Iraq by the terrible mistakes of the Maliki government, gave a tremendous opportunity for these extremists to put their ideas, their takfiri, Salafi, jihadi ideas, into effect.
According to Ambassador Fernandez, that is the same approach Al-Qaeda adopted in other places like northern Mali, Somalia, parts of Yemen, and in northern Nigeria.
But President Obama said the international community needs to address grievances that terrorists exploit, including economic and political issues.
Well, Ambassador Fernandez acknowledged that dealing with the rise of the Islamic State should be a multi-pronged approach, not only in the battlefield. He said it should include better governance, dealing with the socio-economic grievances, deconstructing the hateful ideology of ISIS, opening the political space, and avoiding painting all Islamists with one broad brush as violent extremists.
It won't drive everyone into the ranks of the Islamic State, but it will encourage people to go there. Because if you're accused of being something that you're not, you might as well do it, right? No, this is the problem. The question of political Islam, of the role of Islam expressed in a political world, we have to find a way to do that.
Ambassador Fernandez argued that you can physically crush a group of fighters belonging to ISIS, but if the reasons behind their ideology and if the appeal to join the Islamic State continued, then you did not solve any problem.
That is International Edition correspondent Mohammed El-Shanawi speaking with VOA's Susan Yaki. The Associated Press, that is reporting a draft of a side agreement to the Iranian nuclear deal between the U.N. Atomic Watchdog Agency and Tehran that will allow Iran to use its own inspectors to investigate the secretive Parchin nuclear site. Obama administration expressed confidence in the technical plans of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, for investigating Parchin and previous possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby says that Secretary of State John Kerry is confident that the IAEA will manage its part of these requirements ably and efficiently, as he put it, and Congress has been fully briefed on their contents. Congress is expected to vote to reject the nuclear agreement when it returns from a recess next month. Ambassador James Jeffries, who served in the George W. Bush administration and is now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, tells my colleague Victor Beatty he is shocked over this latest revelation, insisting the Iranians cannot be trusted.
I'm increasingly of the view that this administration will do anything to avoid challenging or irritating the Iranians. They either have such a fixation on this agreement or on the bigger game of what they think is flipping Iran that they simply are not trying to hold it to any kind of standard. This is a country that was pursuing nuclear weapons at that site. I know that. I've seen the intelligence. This is going to reverberate very, very broadly around Congress, as it should. This is worse than ignoring it. This is basically saying that their word is good. It isn't. You know what they're going to report. I'm very, very frustrated.
The White House Wednesday insisted it has confidence in the International Atomic Energy Agency after this report emerged. This is Ned Price of the National Security Council. Quote, we are confident in the agency's technical plans for investigating the possible military dimensions of Iran's former program, issues that in some cases date back more than a decade.
Do they trust the ability of the Iranians to provide answers that we can use as a basis to determine the degree to which Iran was doing very sensitive and sophisticated warhead development? Now, going forward, here's the problem with this. This is, in some respects, a very intrusive inspection regime. But here's the thing. This is where this whole Parchin thing comes in. An intrusive inspection regime is no better than what the international community, read the United States, does if something is found to be amiss, wrong, potentially cheating. And that means that no matter how good the IAEA is at discovering inconsistencies, suspicions, and other things, because you never catch anybody red-handed, the issue is, what will this administration do about it?
Jeffrey says although the latest report will result in a loss of congressional support for the nuclear agreement, it will not likely alter the outcome because he believes Congress won't be able to override a promised presidential veto. Mideast analyst Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco says he believes the criticism of this side agreement is overblown. He describes the IAEA as having a good track record of monitoring nuclear activity around the world.
They do not let countries get away with self-inspections that would in any way threaten their ability to monitor the development of possible nuclear weapons. The site in question is the military facility at Parchin, which has been used for testing new explosives, new engines for missiles and the like, which could have application to nuclear weapons. However, given that there will be very direct, intrusive inspections regarding the enrichment of uranium and other activities that could lead to fissile materials, in many ways, this is not relevant. Even if they did, for example, have tests that could apply to nuclear weaponry, if they don't have the fissile material to develop the nuclear weapon, it's not a threat.
Iran has, of course, refused access in the past to Parchin for years, denying any interest in or work on nuclear weapons. Ali Heinonen, who was in charge of the Iran probe as deputy IAEA director general from 2005 to 2010, said he could think of no similar concession with any other country regarding inspections. Does any of that concern you?
I was somewhat surprised to hear that, because there has been some flexibility in the past. But even if we are to assume that that is correct, the situation with Iran is particularly sensitive around Parshin, given the apparent sabotage a couple years ago, as well as the ways by which they have compromised on a whole series of demands for making this overall the most intrusive inspection regime of any country not defeated in war.
The IAEA has long sought access to Parshin, which is a military base south of Tehran. And according to the Associated Press, Iran is to provide the IAEA with photos and videos of locations it says are linked to alleged weapons work, taking into account military concern. That suggests the agency will be barred from physically accessing that site. Still ahead on International Edition, a weekend of jazz at its best. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The 1980s saw an increase in the number of women who joined their spouses in the workforce. With both parents working and unable to stay at home to care for their children, many of these families had to turn to daycare. As more and more children were enrolled at these facilities, childcare experts expressed concern and started to warn parents about potential harmful effects that daycare could have on a child. This, of course, left the working parent with feelings of guilt and anxiousness. A new study recently published in Psychological Science should bring a measure of relief to those who send their children to daycare. Researchers followed 1,000 Norwegian kids who were sent to childcare facilities and found that the amount of time they spent at daycare had very little to do with aggressive behavior. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now, a little something from the world of jazz. Well, he's done it again. Grammy Award-winning jazz guitarist Earl Klugh just hosted his annual Weekend of Jazz in the U.S. city of Colorado Springs and invited some other world-class talent, such as Burt Bacharach, Dave Grusin, Lee Ritenour, Nicky Yanofsky, and jazz enthusiasts from all over the world simply to have some fun. Klugh's big hit, Dr. Macumba. With more than 30 albums to his credit and dozens of awards, Klugh never stops performing. And as he told Fox 21 TV, it's for good reason.
This really has helped me over time playing the guitar, because basically I'm a shy person. But, you know, I love it. You know, I just really enjoy it.
When you think of the women of jazz, names like Ella Fitzgerald, Nina Simone, and Rosemary Clooney come to mind. But there's some new names on the scene. Nicky Yanofsky's one of them, here singing I Got Rhythm.
I got rhythm, I got music, I got my bed, who can ask for anything more? I got daisies in green pastures, I got my bed, who can ask for anything more? Oh man, trouble, I don't want him, you won't find him around my door. I got starlight, I got sweet dreams, I got my bed, who can ask for anything more?
Representing all the millennials who love jazz, it's 21-year-old Nicky Yanofsky. Would wouldn't be a jazz festival without two of the really great songwriter performers of all time. That's Dave Grusin on the piano. He's written so many award-winning songs for the movies and TV and more. And Lee Ritenour, a guitar virtuoso whose talent is second to none. They're teaming up with a lot of other talent on the stage in Colorado Springs to perform Grusin's Mountain Dance. It doesn't get much better than Dave Grusin, his song Mountain Dance, and of course, Lee Ritenour. Native Son, a film director, a gospel giant, and an award-winning journalist were among the 2015 recipients of McDonald's 365 Black Awards, which recognizes African Americans who excel in their fields and give back to their communities. In its 12th year, the awards program on Sunday night honored, among others, Ava DuVernay, the first African-American female director of films to be nominated for a Golden Globe for the civil rights film Selma, and gospel recording artist and philanthropist Dr. Marvin L. Sapp received the Living Legend Award. And, of course, Trailblazer Award winner Jeff Johnson, an award-winning journalist, runs a Baltimore company called Illum Communications. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After another delay, South Sudan President Salva Kiir appears ready to finally sign the peace agreement negotiated with the help of regional leaders in Addis Ababa. It is a hopeful sign that an end may be near for the crippling factional fighting that has roiled the East African nation for 20 months. On August 17th, the deadline for formalizing the agreement, hammered out in talks sponsored by the Intergovernmental Agency on Development, or IGAD, President Kiir announced that he still had reservations about some aspects of the agreement and wanted 15 more days of consultations with his government before returning to Addis Ababa to sign it. Opposition leader Riek Machar and other parties and stakeholders had signed the agreement, however, leaving many frustrated over the continued struggle. Untold numbers of people have been killed, and more than 2 million have been displaced since fighting broke out in December 2013, when a political dispute between the president and Machar, his former vice president, escalated into intercommunal conflict. Even now, the fighting continues as government troops attacked rebel positions in Imatong hours after Kiir requested more time to consider the deal. 2 days later, however, as the United Nations was considering further steps to discourage fighting and emphasize the need to finalize the agreement, including the establishment of an international arms embargo, President Kiir called U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to say that his concerns had been addressed, and he plans to add his name to the agreement. The United States has welcomed the signing of this agreement by the opposition leader and other key groups, and we urge the government of South Sudan to follow through on its pledge to formalize the deal, which has been agreed to and supported by not only the IGAD states, but also the United Kingdom, Norway, China, the African Union, and United Nations. The United States will continue to consult with international partners on how best to take action against anyone undermining the peace process. President Obama made clear that there will be a price to pay for that intransigence. It's time to sign this agreement and to move forward for the South Sudanese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.